Hi, I'm Joel.
And I'm Kishan.
And this is Tea for Two.
This is our BFF podcast, where we talk about anything from science to popular culture,
the arts and life in Singapore. Hi everyone, it's me, Joel, a playwright and performer.
And it's me, Kishan, a science educator.
And welcome back to
T42.
It's our best friend podcast where we talk about whatever the freedom. We want freedom.
Yeah, we want freedom. Not very difficult to get it. Sheng Siong got sell or not?
Yeah, in the dry goods section.
The dry goods section, because it's so preserved, right?
Yeah. Yeah, anyway, how are you, Kitchen?
Oh, I've been good. I'm just very thankful it's the weekend. I've been looking forward to this weekend for the longest time.
Yeah, as I said many times before, it makes no difference to me. Although I am looking forward to Sunday when it's time for MasterChef.
Oh my god.
Yeah, I don't want to go too in depth into it, but like MasterChef Singapore has started again. And along with MasterChef Singapore, my beloved recap series, which you can
really
catch
good.
On my Facebook.
Yeah, please, everybody, if you don't already know, Joel does this wonderful recap. Yeah.
You can also find it on my blogspot.
Oh, now I've got blogspot.
I set out a blogger. Blogger. Like, this is some like 2000s realness. www.masterchefsingaporerecaps.blogspot.com.
Wow, sister. Easy to find lah.
Quite.
So go and find her. Go and read and like give her all the love.
I love this cross promotion. Alright, you ready to get on with the episode?
Yes, we got heavy things to talk about.
Let's go. Alrighty. It's time for our very first segment of the day.
Are you home, Shirley?
It's a segment in which we discuss an aspect of life in Singapore that either fascinates or horrifies us. Very often,
both.
And what's up for the chopping block today, Kishan?
Something a tad more horrifying,
More horrifying than fascinating.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Is the culture war. Wow, quite drama.
Yeah, culture war.
Yeah, this has been on our minds for quite a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The context for this is also quite recent, right?
Yeah, about a few weeks, I think.
Yeah, I mean, a few episodes ago, we did this thing where we rounded up how January was this really fucking horrible time for LGBTQ rights in Singapore.
Correct.
And then, like, on the back of that, like, Lawrence Wong! Minister for Education, right? Like went in Parliament and said something about like, oh, we need to be very careful about like importing this
our
politics into Singapore. Like culture war. We mustn't be careful of importing this culture war into Singapore.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah, but actually this has been mounting since even before the elections, right? When there was a lot of race discourse that was happening last year.
Yeah, and the politicians were very were wary about us like appropriating all these things from the West.
Yeah, the kind of like idea behind it is that a lot of the way in which we are processing social issues in Singapore is now coming from the West. Mm. And like the term culture war is kind of popping back up from like the early 2020s.
No good.
So I thought right today, I just really want to kind of talk about the idea of the culture wars.
Yes, please.
What
sister.
They are, how the term is being deployed in Singapore, and what it means for us, and why I'm so pissed off with it.
Yeah, you can't tell everybody, but she's pissed.
I'm so pissed.
She's pissed.
I'm pissed.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. I was like, first of all, right, this term has been in circulation for quite a while already.
Culture wars?
Yeah, in Singapore. Like, I remember first reading about it when I was in my teens. So in the 2000s, I guess, when like there were a lot of like LGBT rights coming up in the news and it was constantly in the air, right? And then like our politicians were saying things like, oh, we must be very careful of these culture wars.
Mm, because
and
Singapore is not the West, right?
Yeah, it's not the West. So this idea is not new and it's not specific to this recent like bout of social justice activism. It's been around for a while now, right? But like let's look at the term culture wars, shall we?
Okay.
Like every time I say culture war, so the term actually is American in origin.
Okay.
Right? Like, so to my knowledge at least, and I'm not a scholar of culture wars, so don't quote me on this, right? But to my understanding, it kind of emerged in, I want to say starting from the 60s, but kind of coming up in more prominence from the 70s, 80s onwards in the USA, right? To describe a very specific phenomenon that was happening in the country at that time.
Right.
So if you just cast your mind back to like the 60s or 70s, what's happening in the USA?
All movements.
Correct. You've got this convergence, right, of like the African-American civil rights movement, women's liberation, and then gay rights, right? And they're all coming to a head together in a bottleneck almost.
Right.
In like the 70s or 80s, right?
Yeah, so it's a catalyst for a great change, a lot of change.
Huge change. Yeah. Massive change.
Concentrated
right?
in a specific time Correct. Period. It's a lot, lah.
Correct. And then the term culture war kind of emerged, right, to describe how like these politics, right? Politics of race, politics of like feminism, politics of sexuality
right.
were kind of coming to the fore in American life in many ways. So in the media, in street protests, in the academy, in universities, and then of course in electoral politics as well, right? But then I guess what the term culture war and the reason the word war is in the term is because it is actually describing how these rights movements in asking for more rights and more equality and more justice came up against a very substantial conservative
resistance. So it's like two factions, yeah, basically correct. Warring.
Correct. Mm. And so the term has a kind of like American provenance to describe this clash, I guess, of values, right?
And of course, the Americans will go with the word war.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they want to, you know, because it's so very much in their vocabulary.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So basically, culture war basically just describes equality movement facing up against like
resistance
and then how like I guess the negative term of it and the way we use it nowadays is to describe the way in which this is the dominant form of politics in the USA. You know, so like when you see during the US elections, right, you tend to see that
it's always just these two factions just coming together.
Yeah, candidates tend to get pit against like, oh, what are your views on abortion? What
exactly.
So it can kind of like refer to that slight flattening of the idea of politics in general. Right. So whatever. I want to leave that behind for a sec.
Okay.
So then like, what does it mean that it comes into like the Singapore context, right? How is it used here? So like we've kind of alluded to it briefly already, right? The idea that, oh, it's something that comes from America, something that we must be careful to import. Which, first of all, is very ironic because it's like, you want to warn us against Western influence, but you're using this term that was...
It's crazy.
Yeah, this term that was evolved to describe a specifically American state of affairs. But anyway, like in the Singapore context, it's always used in a kind of like, we don't want divisive politics. All right, so when they say culture wars, they mean we don't want divisive politics. We don't want pushbacks within society. So they like to say, oh, if you ask for rights, you must expect a pushback.
Yeah.
So, you know, better to not ask.
Don't
rock the boat. And then they also use it in the context of like, oh, we don't want to import these identitarian politics or these identity politics. So culture war, as it's used in Singapore, seems to be shorthand for these ideas.
Yeah.
Which to me is... they're all very problematic. That it gives me pause. Let's put it that way. It gives me pause. So I want to start with the idea of pushback.
Right.
Are you familiar with this idea?
Yeah, basically, someone says, I want this, and someone says, no.
Yeah, yeah, but then in Singapore, the term pushback always comes as a cautionary kind of like, better not, little got pushback, pushback.
So then it prevents you from actually, but like all the people who actually want rights then feel very like bad because they feel like they're going to create some sort of like discord
correct.
Or whatever.
But is there anything more fucking tautological and obvious than the idea that if you ask for rights, you will get pushback?
Oh, 100% lah.
I mean,
because
like,
you're definitely going to be unhappy about it.
Yeah, it's like, this one need to say, man. It's really like, it's really like, 1 + 1 = 2. Okay, I might be oversimplifying it.
No, sure.
But it's such a gross tautology to me. And the fact that it's used in it's used to kind of tamp down the asking of rights is very fucking stupid to me. Because like, if you look at the history of human society, it's fraught with the idea of opposition and pushback.
Exactly.
But you don't even have to look back to the Neanderthals to kind of piece this together. Just look at like, you know, those liberation movements I described earlier.
Actually, then this term pushback sort of prevents people from wanting to make the demands heard or make their needs heard.
Exactly.
And then they just keep quiet and they just get clamped down and they just become silent.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what we want, right?
Yeah.
We want people to keep quiet, it seems.
No, I mean, I don't even know if we need to humor it on that level.
Right.
I think that what I'm saying is basically when they say you must expect, don't ask for rights because you invite pushback. It's like, yeah, tell me something new. You know, it's like, it's invalidated on a logical level already to me.
It's
not even worth engaging with that as an idea, basically.
Right,
and I'm wasting so much breath doing it. But what it points to, I guess, in the Singapore context is that, oh, in Singapore, we must do things in a very measured way, you know. We want to, we must slowly process everybody's needs and wants. So if you must wait your turn to talk. You know, wait your turn to talk. Don't ask for it now. Now not a good time.
That's just an excuse to shut people up.
Yeah, yeah, correct.
Ugh.
And kind of outsource responsibility elsewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically a failure of moral leadership. But what that leads to is you stretch something past the point of its natural occurrence and you reach a state of profound absurdity. also, as in the Singapore context, you see this in so many ways, yeah, right?
And also not just profound absurdity, I guess, but also like frustration within a person.
Correct.
Right? You become very like, correct, what now? What can I do? Yeah.
So, I mean, the purest example of this is the 377A situation in Singapore, right? Where it's like what you have is a law on the books that is not enforced, which is absurd to the nth degree. And it's because we want to take this measured approach.
Yeah, correct.
Right? It's way past. It's like an overdue baby that is basically doing its PSLE in the womb. That is the analogy I have in my mind. So this that's what I think about pushback, right?
Right.
Shut up. Pushback on your pushback. So that second idea is this idea of division or divisiveness.
Right.
Right. It's like, oh, you know, culture war is very like, oh, very divisive. We want to avoid those divisive politics. I personally think that the term divisive is that it's very easily thrown out as shorthand for all sorts of things that are never quite clear. They're never very clear when they say what division is or what divisiveness looks like.
Right.
Because if you think about it, right, what society is not divided. Like I feel like society is divided on 1,001 levels of interaction.
Yeah, so they're naturally going to be points of division.
Yeah, no one agrees or aligns in a convenient way all the time. In fact, the history of societies, as I pointed out just now, is a history of negotiation, is a history of tension, is a history of space and space making and claims and counterclaims and all that, right? Societies are by their, human societies are by their nature divided. Human beings are by our nature as individuals divided.
Yeah.
Right?
And so, we must learn to negotiate on this level.
Correct.
We must learn to talk on this level. But right, I guess all these things don't allow us to. Like,
no.
The language around this is like, no, don't.
So when you're saying like, oh, we want to avoid divisive politics, you're basically saying we want to avoid politics. Politics are, you know what I mean? It's, once again, it's tautological to my mind, at least, right? And I mean, the primary division in society, right, is power and powerlessness. And that is the fundament to me of all politics, right? It's basically people with less power asking for a more equal distribution of power. And of course, those in power are going to have issues with that, right? So saying, oh, we don't divisive politics is to kind of draw our attention away from this fundamental imbalance in our society. And of course, the government has a vested interest in drawing attention away from that, right?
But that also turns a blind eye to any sort of oppression, correct, or any sort of marginalized group.
Yeah, exactly. It's like people aren't just asking for rights for fun, you know?
I mean, this
is coming out of some deep, deep shit.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
Deep lived experience shit.
And all of this, actually, because you turn a blind eye to it, then people cultivate this attitude of apathy.
Correct.
They just don't really care.
Correct.
And they really take in this whole idea of let's not rock the boat.
Correct. But to return us to this idea of like divisiveness, right? So the kind of like opposite of division is unity, right? Cohesion. So to say that, oh, society, we don't want divisive politics, is to suggest that we're coming from a place of cohesion. Right.
But sister, let's be real.
Yeah, let's be real. Also, like, there's no such thing as a fully socially cohesive, you know, society or country.
Dystopic lah.
basically totalitarianism, right? The only kind of like, you know, cohesive society is a totalitarian society where no one is allowed to be divisive. And I'd say Singapore comes pretty close to that in some respects. So it's a myth, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and a counterexample that the Singapore government likes to throw out in this respect, right? With regards to, oh, division, they'll always say things like, oh, we must protect our unity and cohesion, like SG50 or whatever, right? Because look at, across the pond at Malaysia,
look at
Taiwan.
Yeah, look at all the unrest everywhere. They fight in parliament.
USA, storm capital, K. Shanmugam comes out and say, better not. Yeah, BLM protests,
Yeah.
It's always, there.
But it's a very false thing to just point out. It's very disingenuous,
saying. Yes, those societies are divided because if we take as our fundamental axiom that all societies are divided, that is a manifestation of division. That is not a manifestation of unruliness. That's a manifestation of deep injustice that people are trying to correct.
To resolve, lah.
Resolve, right? The reason Singapore does not have that is well known.
Yep.
Right, tight controls over all forms of like resistance and dissent.
Correct.
Right, and actually to say I feel like then what happens is that the division becomes internalized on an individual level.
Then you lash out, lah.
Correct. Yeah, at each other on the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is what we see, like queer people get lashed out at all the time.
Yeah,
all the time. It's terrible.
So like you outsource the policing, you outsource it to
individual people.
Individual citizens.
Correct. It's terrible.
It's terrible. So here on T42, you hear first, divisiveness. Myth. Social cohesion, myth. Okay, these are just like fear-mongering words to describe a very natural process of democratic negotiation within a citizenry. Stop it! All right. Then the third thing is this idea of identity politics, right? Mm. So like they'll say, oh, we don't want to bring in this identity politics. So actually, what is identity politics, right?
Mm.
Identity politics is this brand of like politics that does come from, you know, these rights movements that I described earlier. Yeah.
Where it's like LitFem, queer, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, all these things, right? And it's kind of like, obvious, according to its name, like a politics that's based around certain discrete or like specific aspects of your identity.
Sure.
And there are some valid criticisms of like identity politics. The one common criticism is that we need to move towards a more intersectional way of thinking about identity.
A finer way of thinking about
things. Yeah, finer way, more granular way of thinking about
identity.
Yeah, I
think the example you were giving is not just like, for example, feminism. You must think about also like
race and class and the way these intersect,
how all these intersect, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think this is what the Singapore government is thinking of when they say don't bring identity politics in.
Sure.
I think it's, you know, it's basically the same thing I've been saying over and over again, right? It's just like, actually what we want, we don't want people to come in and question power. We don't want people to come in and bring in these destabilizing ideas, because I think the real fear of identity politics here is that identity politics is a people's politics. It is a politics that uses our very lived realities in our bodies and our identities to criticize very deep and nefarious structures of power in our societies.
It's so individualized that it's frightening.
Exactly. And it's true identity politics that we've witnessed social movements in the past.
Oh yes.
Right? Yeah. And I think that is the great fear here, that it is a destabilizing politics, because it is people saying, look, my life is shit because of you. Let's do something about it. And it's questioning the status quo. It's questioning, you know, policy. And it's questioning the way things are run. Of course, it's destabilizing, right? Because all negotiation is on some level destabilizing. It's basically renegotiating the social contract. And all things are in flux until a contract can be locked down, right? What we have in Singapore is a case of a pre-written contract being forced down everyone's throats.
Yeah,
with
we
no
all
room
have
for
to,
negotiation.
Yeah, we all have to subscribe to it, right?
Correct.
Terrible.
So, because in my mind, right, a good identity politics is a politics that points out the oppression of all people in a society. When we think about like the protests in front of MOE, the young people protesting against,
five of them
protesting against discrimination of trans people within schools, right? I thought that was such a flashpoint, because not only is it making a claim for more equality, mm-hmm. for equality for trans people, it's also pointing out that right to protest is very tenuous, right? So it's pointing out for everyone in this country our subjection to a very problematic law.
I think what gets me is what you said about the fact that we are coming, or policies seem to, this idea of let's not rock the boat comes from the idea that we are already a cohesive society.
Mm.
And this illusion that we are, all everybody's holding hands and everyone is happy. I think that we need to lift that mask up a little bit. We really are, there are oppressed groups, and these groups need to be listened.
Yeah.
And to tell them that this is not the time for you, it's just not being compassionate enough.
Yeah,
I think that is a problem.
This is a good time to read an Audre Lorde quote. Because of course she's the grandmother
of course she has everything.
Of intersectional politics.
Yeah, correct.
But to write off what you were saying, this seems particularly apt. So she writes, "Those of us who stand outside the circle of this society's definition of acceptable women," and here you can just put in whatever identity marker, "those of us who have been forged in the crucibles of difference, those of us who are poor, who are lesbians, who are black, who are older, know that survival is not an academic skill. It is learning how to take our differences and make them strengths. For the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. They may allow us temporarily to beat him at his own game, but they will never enable us to bring about genuine change. And this fact is only threatening to those women who still define the master's house as their only source of support."
So saith Audre Lorde.
So this, if you extrapolate what Lorde is saying to what we've been talking about, basically the idea of stability, cohesion, these are the master's tools. So this is the way in which the master in this case is trying to get us to engage, right? Respectfully, obediently, or not at all, right? And this makes me think a lot about how this fear of instability that is at the heart of our government's rejection of politics in general is very ironic, because they don't see how this instability is of their own creation.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Correct.
It's like this instability comes from policy. This instability comes from a history of suppression of various kinds of like rights and freedoms. And this instability comes from a lack of moral leadership.
And I think instability specifically for Singapore is like what I said earlier, it's about frustration. Everything looks very honky-dory from like when we just look out into Singapore and go like, wow, everything's so nice. But I think if you dig deeper and you talk to people, there's always this undercurrent of something.
Yeah.
And it differs for
deep
different people.
Deep frustration, deep apathy, deep psychosis, neurosis on some level.
And it's actually very scary, like, that I think most of us have something like that going on.
Yeah.
And I agree that it's born from the way things are done in Singapore right now.
Yeah. And I think the fact that the internet has liberalized the way of communicating this frustration is a threat, you know, to the incumbent government, because it does seem outwardly very rabble rousing. It does seem very angry. And I come from a point of view where, like, yeah, whatever, of course it's angry.
Yeah.
But they're like, oh, this anger must be contained, without realizing where the anger comes from.
Why is anger always seen like a negative thing? It's okay to be angry, right? Yeah. But I don't know, because I guess anger is an uncontrollable force here. Yeah. Like, in a country where control means everything, anger is frightening.
Like, we seem to forget that, like, as a post-colonial society, the root of our republic politics is nationalist anger. Mm. Right? I mean, albeit here it was conducted in a very different way. There was no kind of outright nationalist movement, whatever. But it does come from that root of injustice, right? Hey, why did David Marshall go to engage with the British? He wanted independence of Singapore. Mm. That's a form of, like, liberatory politics, right? At a time when that was one of the great oppressive structures in the world, right? So I think there's a lot to be said here about the Singapore government just kind of misrecognizing its own role in the instability that it warns us of. It's very sleight of hand, you know. It's very like Tai Chi,
right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's it. I think you've talked about a lot, like, how certain many of these terms are quite disingenuous, right? Mm. But I think where I come from and where I actually see a little bit of progress. Like, I think the government is starting to realize that a lot of these things, we need to have a change in mindset, you know? And there is some change, albeit very slowly.
Yeah. No, so I've been reading this book called PAP versus PAP by Charin George and Donald Low.
Yeah.
And, like, it's a very good book that lays out how, like, the PAP government is at a juncture where it can really reevaluate its approach to things and become more flexible and nimble and to evolve with the changing times, right? And the next 5 to 10 years and beyond of Singapore politics depends on how much they
agree,
how much they adapt to
and
this.
And they know it. They 100% know this.
Because, you know, but then coming out and saying things like culture war, you know, and kind of like phasing all politics through this idea of, like, Western influence is very naive to me.
Mm.
Right? And that makes me want to think about this Western influence thing a bit more. Like, the idea that, you know, these are politics that are imported from the West, whatever. I find this, like, I mean, there's some truth to it insofar as, like, for example, social justice language, right? A lot of it does come from Western activism, right? But that's because, like, social justice is a global movement,
right?
But then this idea that we can't import it, you know, it's Western, we must do things in our own way, actually is a misrecognition of the global order in which we live, right? Because, like, the fact that we are a post-colonial society means that we are naturally belated to certain forms of modernity, right? But it's basically the idea that the way in which we think of modernity is...
Got examples to see,
And if you look at the global order, the modern global order, it's fundamentally liberal in nature, because the history of the development of the current world order is a liberal trajectory, right? And then Singapore wants to benefit from this liberal world order, but also do things its own way.
Yeah, like, it's a beautiful contradiction.
Yeah, it's very contradictory.
Mm.
Because if you look at it, right, Singapore does identify as a modern liberal state. If you look at our pledge, what are the words in there?
Yeah, like,
progress,
equality,
democracy, equality, freedom for all, right? These are liberal values that were literally, you know, first espoused in the 18th century French Revolution, you know, and that have led to development of, like, the kind of liberal world order that we live in today.
Right.
So to say we don't want Western influence is to have one's cake and eat it, is to say we want to live in this liberal world, we want to live and benefit from it, but we don't want your influence.
But it's because this country is so carefully curated.
Yeah, correct.
You know, and we all have this in our minds from education. Mm. You know, we all have this in mind that we are perfect, cohesive, wonderful, harmonious society.
Yeah.
So I totally believe that we buy it.
That's the myth of the Singapore way, lah.
Yeah,
because,
correct,
like, the Singapore way, right, they keep saying, oh, if so, what's the corollary to don't want Western influence? The corollary to that is, oh, we must do it our own way. So if you look at it, right, what is our own way? It is that which is oppositional to the modern liberal world order. So it's things like autocracy, lah, basically. It's suppression of the press. It's suppression of protest.
Yeah.
It's abdicating with moral leadership over pressing urgent social issues.
And add on to that, this whole idea of, you know, that this wonderful utopia that we've created can be taken away from us. It's just like, wow, wonderful.
It bears repeating, I guess, that this myth of the cohesive Singapore society is a totalitarian vision. I mean, maybe totalitarian is a bit strong. Yeah, but I say it's an autocratic vision.
Yeah,
right.
Because I mean, we can say it's totalitarian. We can say it's autocratic. But I mean, like what you pointed out earlier, our early politicians, like Lee Kuan Yew, they were creative geniuses.
They were innovators.
Yeah.
They had incredible foresight and they were nimble and adaptive.
Yeah.
Also reactionary. You know.
I think government now is still very reactionary.
Still very reactionary, but it has none of that nimble-footedness, I feel.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is required to kind of navigate this very tricky terrain we're entering.
Like you said, like, it's the next 5 to 10 years. That's where we will see whether they take what Chairman George said, whether they can re-innovate and rebrand themselves in a particular way.
Mm. Ah, well, let's hope. Let's hope.
Yeah. If not, how? Hey. Now it's time for Lukewarm Takes. Ooh. We're two elder millennials.
That's us.
Talk about something that's happening in the world today.
Ooh, and what's happening in the world today, Kishan?
So many things happening. Sometimes, you know, what to do? You bump into people wrongly. You say bad things. Then very awkward leh. Very awkward.
So today on T42, we're going to give you a survival guide to awkward situations.
It's a how-to leh. How to survive.
How to survive. And our operative sound effect for this is...
I love that you said operative.
How to survive awkward situations.
Correct.
Right. This idea came to us courtesy of our friend Wish.
Yeah.
Wish, if you're listening, hi.
Hi, Wish.
Thanks for this idea.
Yeah. Also, like, we've been in like so many awkward situations ourselves.
Yeah. My life is an awkward situation.
We have a fucking Rolodex of awkward situations.
Out of which we're only picking a few.
A few. But enjoy.
Shall we get started?
Yes, please.
All right. Scenario number one. You are on a train reading your book.
Oh, yeah.
The Communist Manifesto.
Oh, of course.
You look up from the Communist Manifesto and you see from across the train none other than Sally, your secondary school friend.
Eh? Sally?
You try to avoid eye contact, but Sally has always been very good at making awkward situations more awkward.
Yeah, Sally.
So she looks you right in the eye, smiles, and crosses over to you.
Yeah, like she's coming leh.
She sits down next to you. Hey, hello! Very long I never see you,
Oh my god, I can't stand Sally.
And then you're like, Sally, nice to see you. Where are you going?
Yeah.
She says, Boon Lay. And your heart sinks because you're also going to Boon Lay.
Oh, sister, that was gripping.
Thank you.
That was gripping.
That's the question. Yeah. What do you do, Kishan?
Oh my god. Knowing that I live in Simei and Simei to Boon Lay is a long ride.
Yeah.
Firstly, that was very good. I will ask, if I ever meet someone I don't want to meet on a train, right? And this happened before.
Or
I just don't want to have a conversation. I'm just tired. I will always ask, where are you going? And I will always mark that spot. And then I always say like, oh, I'm getting off before that. And then I actually get out and I take the next train.
So you will ask for the destination first.
I will always ask.
That's a very good idea.
I will always ask and I will always extricate myself from this because I think getting out and delaying myself for 3 minutes to take the next train is worth it.
Worth the peace of mind, right?
I don't want.
This deserves a...
The power of Christ compels you!
Very good. Very good.
What would you do?
Me being me, right, I will actually not survive this situation because I would like sit down and actually have a conversation with this person because like I'm all about like you know, you never know where life takes you. Maybe this will be my next time partner.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Is that how it's going to work?
It's never worked out this way. It's always been painfully excruciating. I mean, to be fair, sometimes it's always nice to catch up with people you haven't seen in a long time. Even if it's just very small talky.
I cannot stand small talk. I really am not that type of person.
Usually
I'm just very tired and if I'm sitting by myself, I just want to be by myself.
Right.
Yeah, I just cannot.
Well, the few times this has happened to me, right, like, and I've not wanted to be in that conversation, I've not been as smart as you to go, hey, where are you going? I'll just quickly go like, my stop, and then like sometimes got contradiction. Was like, I thought you were going to, like, oh no, no, this one I didn't go supermarket, this one I prefer the cold storage here to that one. And now I'll spill off the train very unconvincingly.
Why you say cold storage? Did you mean Sheng Siong?
Correct, Sheng Siong.
Sorry, Sheng Siong.
We're still trying to court your sponsorship. The best thing to do, right, is you see someone, you quickly move to the next carriage so you don't make eye contact.
I've also done that.
Correct.
Quickly, just like, oh, you know, just pretend to be asleep.
Correct.
I just cannot. I just don't want to be in that situation.
No, let's get out of it.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we move on?
Yes, let's. Scenario two.
Scenario two.
Yeah. You've just come out of a very tense meeting where you've just been scolded at by your boss. But then as you leave the meeting, as you're walking back to your, you know, to your office, you suddenly have the best comeback. And then you just let it all out. You say all that you want to say.
She's not a Christian!
You actually vocalize walking down the corridor, thinking you're alone. You have it out, you know, this imaginary boss now. But then as you turn the corner, your colleagues are all there, or in my case, students are there, looking at you, wildly gesticulating at nothing and having this conversation all to yourself, talking to yourself. What do you do?
She's not a Christian!
Very awkward.
Very awkward. So basically, it's this idea of talking to yourself, lah.
And being caught talking to
being
yourself.
Being caught talking to yourself.
This happens to me, or you won't believe how much this happens to me.
Same!
Yeah.
It happens to me all the fucking
apparently
time.
Talking to yourself is a kind of like neurosis, you know?
Is it?
Yeah.
I think it's great.
Yeah.
Like, I talk to myself because I don't know, like, it's not because I don't have anyone to talk to. I just talk things out sometimes, or I have imaginary conversations. Right. I don't know, I think it helps.
So for me, when I'm talking to myself and someone intrudes on my space, I'll suddenly go, oh.
You mumble into softness.
Or I'll pretend that I was like rehearsing a speech.
That's good. Yeah. That's actually not bad.
What do you do?
So I just lean in. I go like, I'm sorry, I'm just talking to myself.
That is so weird.
No, I just lean. So it's happened to me many, many times. Like if I think I'm in a staff room by myself,
right?
I would just have full-on conversations about stupid emails. I go like, oh, I can't believe I have to do this. This is really dumb. Why don't they just do it this way? Blah, 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 blah. Then someone will walk in. And then they were like, oh, who are you talking to? I was like, no, I'm just talking to myself.
I'm like, none of your business, Carol.
No, because I think we should normalize talking to ourselves.
Okay.
And just say, no, I'm just talking to myself.
Right. Yeah. But this is an interesting learning point in that when you're caught in an awkward situation, sometimes the best thing to do
is lean into it. Lean
fucking in. Because you will push past the point of awkwardness into, I don't know what.
Yeah.
But victory, maybe.
Yeah, so like if ever students catch me talking to myself and it's happened, they always think it's a little bit weird, but I just tell them, no, I'm just talking to myself because it's what I do.
No, next time you should say, you made me so stressed until I talk to myself.
I've said that before.
Yeah, you made me so stressed until teacher siao already. Teacher siao liao. Teacher siao liao. You got to do your homework or not? You got to do your homework or not?
Not a question!
Yeah, so let that long.
Okay,
let that long.
They're very good, very good.
Next scenario. You're walking along Orchard Road. And then you see Roger right in the distance.
Hi, Roger.
Long time never see. Like, hi, Roger, your girlfriend. You give Roger a wave. You know, you give Roger a very enthusiastic wave. You're so happy to see him. And then Roger waves back. Of course, why wouldn't Roger wave back? You're good friends. And then as you get closer, you realize, salah leh. Not Roger. It's nobody you even know.
What would you do? Dear listener, what would you do?
Has this happened to you?
Oh, all the time.
But you wait. No, the waving wrongly at somebody is one thing.
But then they react.
They react. They wave back because they're trying to be polite.
Yeah,
they go like, oh, maybe I forget you.
You know why? Because on the other side, they're also like, oh, maybe I forgot who this person is.
Exactly.
So it's like now you are yoked together by awkwardness.
Yes.
How do you escape?
Maybe like, you know, lasting friendships can actually come out like that. I'm sure there are stories out there like, this is actually how people became friends.
No.
You don't, you don't think so?
No, because like, there's always like, suspicion of strangers. So it's like, it reaches a point, it's like, is this person trying to swindle me?
Oh.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, so like, when I've done it to women, especially, there's an added element of, oh, is he a creep?
No, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
So it can be quite awkward.
Yeah.
So I always lean in and go, I'm so sorry, I thought you were somebody else, because you really look like that, and I just end up talking too much.
No, that's exactly what I do. Right? For me, the idea about awkward situations is that if you really don't know what to do and you cannot extricate yourself from it, just lean in and say, sorry.
Actually, this could turn quite sexy, like you were suggesting, right?
Right?
Like, talk, until they go like, oh, actually, you're quite funny. Quite cute.
Can we exchange numbers? And then like, things happen.
Yeah, I feel like this is also the setup of like a Just for Laughs sketch.
Correct.
Practical prank, right?
Last time.
Last time. Remember like,
Just for Laughs used to be a thing.
Remember Gotcha?
Oh my god! Oh my god! Gotcha.
Yeah, it was like a riff off like Hidden Camera, right?
Yeah.
They like to, this scenario has played out on Gotcha before.
I'm sure it has.
Yeah, where they wave, and then the person think, who, me? And then they walk past and it's like, oh, paiseh, quah, quah. It's like, you know what? I think the embarrassment here is that everybody's afraid to look like they have no friends.
I think that's a bit silly.
Okay, this is like quite a common everyday occurrence.
Yeah.
Especially if you're very popular and have a lot of friends. Yeah. Like me. Okay.
What's the next scenario?
Next scenario is, you are at a party over wine and cheese. Your friend brings someone to meet you.
Ooh.
You shake hands and you say, oh my god, hi, it's really nice to meet you. Mm. And they go, we've actually met before.
Ooh, girl.
Pit in the stomach. And then you go, oh, of course, you're... I remember. They look you in the eye. They challenge you. You drop your wine.
Pew! Oh my goodness.
Forget name, eh?
Forget name.
To someone who claims you've been introduced before.
Actually, that happens to me quite
a bit.
Quite a bit.
Yeah. First of all, let's get to the root. Why is it so embarrassing?
I don't know.
Because it suggests a certain callousness on your part.
No,
right?
No, yeah. You're right. But... I'm always in a situation where I remember the person's face. So because I remember the face
more than names.
Then I would just call it out. I'm so sorry. Right. I don't remember your name.
Yeah. Actually, the more common occurrence is actually you recognize the person. Then actually you're like, oh shit, I forget the name.
All the time.
Yeah. So how do you get yourself out of this situation?
It really depends from situation to situation. If I can remove myself from the situation, if a person is like just a passing acquaintance and I really don't want to interact with the person, I'll just remove myself.
You just walk away.
I'll just walk away.
It's like, my Grab coming. My Grab coming.
Yeah, I'll just be like, oh, hi, bye.
Then 1 hour, hey, you're still here. Yeah, my Grab came and then I went and I came back.
You know, it's not cock and bull story like that. But if I have to interact with this person for the longest time, like if we are seated next to each other suddenly in like a play, no choice. I just go like, I'm so sorry, I just forgot your name.
Sorry. Yeah. I never do that.
No.
You know what I will do?
What?
This is foolproof strategy.
Oh no.
100% of the time it works.
Oh no.
I will introduce them to someone else at the party and let them introduce their name.
That can backfire.
Nope. It never backfires. Because you never go, hi Andrew, I'd like you to meet sorry, I forgot your name. You would do that. You was like, hi Andrew, have you met? No, it's like, hi Andrew, it's like blah blah blah, you talk, and then the person is just standing there, right?
Yeah.
And then like, and you go, oh wait, have you met? And then they'll introduce each other.
Right.
100% of the time this works.
Oh, you introduce them to another person.
Another way I like to do this is I'll say, hey, do you have an Instagram? Because you chat. So you skirt around forgetting the name and then you say, hey, You got Instagram or can I have your number? And then you ask them to put the details in.
That's very clever.
Foolproof.
Hey, the Instagram thing is very good. I remember the Instagram thing.
Yeah, the worst thing is say, oh, I don't have Instagram. Then you'd be like, oh, bye.
Not worth.
It's like, the only people worth interacting with are people with Instagram
profile. Correct.
Yeah. This is a foolproof strategy, I say, for
that's
us.
Very good.
Yeah,
I remember
good, right?
that.
Yeah.
I like the Instagram one. Well done, sister.
I'm a social barifry.
What's next?
Oh, next one's very juicy.
I'm very scared.
You receive a DM from your friend. They've sent you an Instagram story. That's super cringe.
Right.
Someone is doing something damn fucking stupid.
Ew.
You reply, oh my god, they are so cringe. I can't believe they're still doing this in 2021. Can they get a life?
Right.
You send the message.
Right.
You look up.
Oh no.
Diala, you've replied to the actual story.
Oh.
This one's not even awkward. This one's mortifying.
It's a full-on scream moment. Yeah.
Basically, it's the scenario in which you send the bitchy message to the person in question and not your friend.
Yeah, thinking that you sent it to your friend.
This is not just Instagram. This has happened on WhatsApp before. This has happened on SMS. This has happened on MSN.
I think it can happen on Instagram more easily because of the way it's structured.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, because replying to stories can be very convoluted.
You must really look one.
Yeah.
You must be very careful about this. So what do you do, Joel? What do you do?
The few times this has happened to me. So there was once this one happened to me, right? Like someone sent me a story or something that I really had a very violent reaction to. It was something that was organized by someone. Basically, it's a kind of reading. And
right.
I was responding to the poets that were reading at the thing. And then I sent, I really hate this, referring to the poets to to the reading organizer.
Oh my god.
The minute I realized my mistake, and this was before Instagram could delete message, right? I just faster blocked. It was so cowardly.
I'm sorry. So on the receiving end, all they saw is, I fucking hate
and then
this.
Block. And then block. Because...
I'm sorry. It sounds like you doubled down on the hatred.
Yeah, no. I block. Because I only found out that... I just assumed that they never saw it or whatever, right? Cut to maybe 3-4 years later, right?
Oh my god!
I unblocked this person just so we could interact on something. And I completely forgotten. And then I saw my message and they actually replied, what do you hate about it? And I just like, in 100% like whatever, I just I just ignored the 3 years ago exchange and
you
went like,
powered
hey,
through.
Hey, how are you? Yeah. But my
that is mortifying.
I'm very cowardly, so I block. Yeah.
Oh dear.
I have never not blocked.
I don't think I've ever blocked anyone on Instagram. Oh no, God, like some nonsense people. No, like,
okay,
blocked,
if you are very quick, right, you can faster delete before they see.
Sure.
But sometimes that's just not an option. Then what do you do?
Sometimes
do you
people are really very on the ball with their social media. They will check immediately, kind. Yeah. Oh my God, that's very scary. The one time or the few times this happened to me, I basically just spun a story out of it.
You recontextualize it, right?
I recontextualize it and then I word my way out of it, lah.
Right.
You know, and I don't know. So far, it's worked, but I don't know whether it's actually worked because I don't know if they bought it.
Right. Or actually, whatever. You know, now that I think about it, the best thing to do is to quickly put, haha, JK. Yeah, JK absorbs everything, right? Like, lol, JK, I love it. Just like lie through your teeth, like, ah, ha, 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 JK, JK, JK.
You know what? That might actually work.
Yeah. Emoji, soften the blow.
Yeah, soften the blow. Distract I can't wait for the them. Next time this happens to me. I'm going to try that.
Misdirection.
Yeah, correct.
The magician's number one tool. Yeah. Misdirect
all the way.
I love it. Lol, JK.
Oh my God, this has been very useful set of, like, you know, how to's.
I would say so. Dear listeners, tell us what you think. Correct. And like, if you have more awkward situations you'd like us to think about, just send them our way.
Or more importantly, if you have more awkward situations that you know how to extricate yourself from,
we want solutions. We want solutions.
Yeah, we want solutions. Help us navigate our awkward lives.
Because in this overcrowded world, we're getting closer and closer to people, and that just means more and more awkward situations.
Yeah.
I think there are awkward situations we haven't even dreamt of yet that we will encounter in the next few years.
So, you know, we want to pull everybody's knowledge into it. Help us, guys. Help us.
Let's get out of it. All right, it's time for Bite-Sized Science. It's that segment in which our resident science expert, Kishan Kumar Singh, gives us some bite-sized science to get through 21st century living.
Yes.
What do you have for us today, Kishan?
Nothing says 21st century living like ASMR.
The number of times we've been told to do an ASMR podcast.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I'm very curious about ASMR, actually. Yeah.
So that's what I want to talk about today. So I was thinking about what to talk about today, and I stumbled on this ASMR video like on my YouTube feed, and I was like, oh my God, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
So ASMR stands for Auto Sensory Meridian Response. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's just a very fancy schmancy term for a feeling that some people experience in response to different triggers.
And they're all auditory.
Ah, that's the thing. It may not necessarily be auditory. Mm. So the feeling itself is usually a tingling, warm sensation that starts from the top of your head and then travels down your neck and then down your spine. So some people who study this call this a brain orgasm.
I recognize the feeling.
Huh? Yeah. Do you?
Yeah.
Because not everybody has this, you know.
I've had it before, yeah.
So it's very interesting and it was quite interesting to read about. So, like I said, some people are more susceptible to it than others. And those who experience it on a sliding scale. So the degree in which you experience this is over a range. Some experience this quite violently, like an electric shock to the system.
Right.
That doesn't sound
so
pleasant.
So painful.
No, it's always pleasant. Right. It's always pleasant, but it's jolting.
Right. You know, like a zap. Mm.
But that sounds frightening to me.
It depends on who you are. Don't kink shame.
You know what? I'm sorry. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Carry on.
For other people, and most of them, they experience this, and this was a very funny description, like carbonated bubbles in a glass of champagne.
Ooh.
Like, bloop, 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 bloop.
I've definitely had that feeling.
It's also a weird description, but also quite pleasant, huh?
I want to be in bubble. I want to be a glass of champagne. Just, you know, feel what? Things fizzing inside
Yeah,
me.
I want to be effervescent.
Yeah.
I want to effervesce. Yeah,
I want to effervesce.
Yeah, not bad, huh?
Very good.
So, what actually causes this? The triggers themselves vary from person to person. The number one trigger, can you guess?
Sound.
Specific? Can you be more specific? Do you know?
Whispering?
Absolutely.
Oh,
right.
Is it really?
It's number one trigger when people were polled is hush whispers.
Ah.
And it's the top trigger. The next are like the next few triggers are like soft speaking. So like that, not like actually that. A whisper.
Right.
Then tapping. And this really weird one. Yeah, like that. That sounds really gross.
That sounds very sexual, yeah.
And another one, which I thought was really weird.
Is it crinkling?
No, fluid sounds.
Or like water?
Like water or like putty.
Okay,
you know,
keep talking. I'm going to try and find some props.
Yeah, so those sorts of things. But it's, as you were saying just now, it's not just sound. It's triggered by all sorts of other things, like watching people do things repetitively. Receiving personal attention. So if someone is on the screen, right, just like putting their hands and touching the screen, so it's like touching your face, it can actually cause ASMR for some people.
Okay, so is ASMR that sensation when someone starts kissing your ear? Because I get that tingly sensation down the back of my spine when someone comes close to my ear. Not even to like kiss it, but to just whisper in my ear.
The whispering, yes.
Yeah.
The whispering for sure.
Oh,
but
I
the kissing, I think maybe maybe not. It's not so much touch. It's always like auditory and like visual.
Right.
Not so much touch, I guess. Also hand movements. If you see hand movements moving in a particular way, it can actually cause ASMR. And listening to certain types of music can cause that. So, I mean, we've all heard of the ASMR creators, right? It led to this crazy explosion
Actually,
online.
From my memory, this started out when some people were watching these old Bob Ross painting videos. You know Bob Ross, the painter, who spoke in a... So I think he combined multiple triggers.
Right?
He spoke very softly and there was tapping sounds and it's repetitive. So a lot of people responded to Bob Ross, and then that's when this in the fascination with ASMR started, right?
Yes.
And now it's become, like you were going to say, this like massive content industry,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So you were right that a lot of people actually experienced ASMR in the beginning through Bob Ross. It was through the paintings, through the tapping sounds and the way he spoke. And people were very entranced by it. But back then, people didn't understand what they were feeling. In fact, ASMR as a phenomenon only had language in the very early 2000s, and it's because of YouTube.
Oh.
So YouTube allowed for the language to appear because people started to talk about it, people started to do videos.
Probably the comment section were like, does anybody else feel like it having an orgasm when
you're
watching Bob Ross?
Exactly. So that was that. So then because the community became wider, then this became a thing.
I love that.
Yeah, I know. It's so beautiful, right? Then the scientific community came in and they were like, okay, you are all saying this, but what is the science behind it? And are you actually experiencing it? Because just because you're saying it doesn't mean it's real, lah. So a very interesting study was conducted only in 2018. So this science is like ridiculously new. So where they wanted to compare the differences between people who said they experience ASMR and people who don't. So what they did was they took 1,000 odd people and asked them to watch ASMR videos and non-ASMR videos. And they took a survey of how they felt afterwards. And those who said that they had ASMR all responded feeling a greater sense of calm. Come after the whole thing, and those who didn't experience ASMR didn't have this sense of
calm.
They
just didn't feel anything.
They didn't feel anything. But again, this is just people say, right?
Right.
So they did physiological tests. They took 100 people, half of them who experienced ASMR and half of them who didn't, and they did some physiological readings, like took their heart rate, sweat glands, all these sorts of things. And those who experienced ASMR, actually, when they were experiencing ASMR, their heart rate dropped by 3 beats per minute. Like.
Oh.
So they
calmed down.
They really calmed down. It was fascinating. And my favorite study was this one. So this group of scientists, they conducted brain scans of people watching ASMR videos. So it was only 10 people because I guess brain scan lah. Then researchers basically compared those who watch ASMR videos and while they're watching ASMR videos and non-ASMR videos. And the part of the brain that lights up, and this was fascinating, when someone experiences ASMR, this tingling sensation, is the same area when someone is being groomed, cared for, or when they're thinking about their partner. So ASMR basically is a feeling of being taken care of.
Yeah, I was going to say all the stuff we've been talking about circles around the same set of ideas. Comfort, love, tenderness, being cared for, being protected.
Yep.
Which is quite sad and touching.
It is. It is. But there's a lot of questions that scientists don't know. Why is it only of some people experience this, some people don't? What is the evolutionary significance of experiencing ASMR? Are you at an advantage? Are you at a disadvantage?
Right.
So people don't have answers to this.
I wonder,
fascinating,
if it's not too dissimilar to why cats purr. Do you know what I mean? Because I don't know, I mean, you're not a cat person, but like if you play with cats, right, and you stroke their heads and you stroke them, they just, like, their whole body starts to shudder. And it sounds like maybe they're having an ASMR response to being stroked.
Could be, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you experience ASMR?
I do, but very rarely. And it's usually in moments of like intimacy, or like someone comes really close to me and starts like touching my head and like stroking me or whatever, right? I mean, not necessarily in a sexual way either.
Yeah.
So I think it has to do, and I think the reason why it's so divided is I think because, and why there's so many different triggers, I suspect it's because different people have different needs, right? And different like lacks in their life. And so like this sense of being cared for, this sense of vulnerability is attached to different things.
Maybe? That's exactly what some scientists are hypothesized.
Well, I can be scientist, eh?
You can, really can one. Yeah, so it's fascinating. And so, you know, true to T42 form.
Oh, yes.
We want to, you know, give you some live ASMR moments.
Yeah, we want to comfort and take care of you, our dear listeners, for
listening
to us.
We want you to be close with us. Mm. So as we slowly transit our voice into the ASMR voice.
Like Kishan, how are you today?
I'm very fine, thank you.
Dear listener, if you can still hear us, you better maybe turn up the volume.
Yeah, or you know, don't.
Why just don't turn up? Just can you hear us in your ear?
Yeah, that's where we are.
Yeah. Oh, we just want to thank you for listening to us all this time.
Yes.
Even though we are very shrill most of the time.
Correct. So this is quite a departure from our usual expressive mode. We also want to thank Xing Xiong.
Yes. Xing Xiong is very good for ASMR because it's so sibilant.
Oh yeah.
Xing Xiong.
Correct.
Xing Xiong, we want sponsorship.
Correct, Xing Xiong.
Yeah.
Can you hear this?
Yeah, so pleasurable.
This receipt is from Xing Xiong. Can you hear this paper? It's from Xing Xiong.
Can you hear this? This plastic bag is from Xing Xiong.
Oh, so good. Plastic bag sounds very good.
Yeah.
Oh, very
Xing Xiong,
nice.
If you can hear us, we want your sponsorship.
Yes, please, Xing Xiong.
Okay, can we do some sexual air, blow air into our listeners' ears?
Can you go first? Is it working?
I actually feel tingly.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Well, you do yourself, Anna.
You can
auto ASMR.
Because we got in-ear monitor. Yeah. So I'm hearing my voice. Wow. We should buy binaural mic.
We should. Are you enjoying this, listeners?
Dear listeners, how do you feel? If you're having a brain orgasm, tell us about it in the comments.
Correct.
Yeah, this is assuming you have followed us on Instagram.
Alright, we're back!
Why so kanchong, sister?
No, because like, you know, we have to transit from the ASMR back to this normal shrill, our normal
correct.
Shrill quality,
so
right?
People are used to us, right? Like, it's still us, guys.
Alright, sadly, we've come to the end of today's episode of T42. It's been yet another episode, yet another week.
Yes.
In this endless toil we call life.
Sister, her voice is very bleak.
Yeah. Dear listeners, thank you so much for listening to this episode.
Life is wonderful, by the way, not bleak. Come on.
Okay, you're kidding yourself, Kishan. Life is wonderful and bleak.
Oh, you know what? I'll take that.
Yeah.
I'll take
Speaking
that.
Of bleak, I have to run off to do a Zoom meeting now. Can you believe it? Yeah, it's the thing that actually pays the bills, not this fucking podcast.
Wow, sister's
right?
So busy. I do podcast, then go Zoom. Wow. Working girl.
Yeah, I'm a working woman. Alright, thanks again for listening to another episode of T42. We'll see you next time. This is Joel signing off.
And this is Kishan. Bye-bye.
He's not a Christian.